every year at this time, George Bailey stands on a bridge in the cold, dark, and looks down on the waters and thinks about hurling himself into the icy waters and ending his pain, ending his loneliness, ending his life. Since 1946, George Bailey has been standing on that bridge. And from the time that we first got our 9-inch Philco television, I've been watching George faithfully on that bridge. And that movie spoke to me. Something has drawn me to that bridge with George. And I know that there's a lot of, that it has become a classic, that it's on every year, sometimes depending on who's owning the copyright and how the networks are struggling with Ted Turner. Sometimes it's on 15 times a season, sometimes only once. And people are drawn to it or they wouldn't show it. There's also, of course, the reaction, the blowback of people who talk about it as being sentimental and schmaltzy and a fine example of what is called Capricorn. And that is the corn, the movies that Frank Capra sometimes did. I disagree. I don't think that it's corny at all. I think that, in fact, when you actually look at it and pay attention to it, it's extraordinarily dark social commentary. Here in this corny movie is a man who is committing suicide, who has just run out of energy and hope. Here is a society where greed and capitalism and dreams that are as shallow and false and distorted as Willie Loman's drives George and drives Mr. Potter into acts that are sad on George's part and despicable on Potter's part. It's a movie that has real depth to it. But I'm not here to do a movie review. I'm here to talk about the depths. Talk about what is it that took George Bailey to that ledge and made it seem like a good idea to end his life, to end his pain. How could this happen to a good person, to a decent person who had lived his life well? We are born with certain fears. We learn some fears. We are taught some fears. But we are born with two very essential fears, a fear of falling and a fear of abandonment. And George felt that he fell, from the esteem of his family and of his community, that he fell from grace. And falling from grace to a bridge, he was ready to complete the fall by plunging into the icy eternity of that river and of death. That he had a family who loved him, couldn't get through his filters. Such was his pain and his sense of disappointment and abandonment by just a larger world. The songs that were being sung at the time. It was Christmas. You all know that. The songs that his daughter are playing, his daughter is playing, they don't soothe his soul. They don't calm him. All of the carols, all of the joy of the season, all of the hope, all of the romanticism really makes this a counterpoint to the ebbing of his own faith. While in the bar, he offers up a prayer, God, oh, please help me. And the next thing that happens is, because he has lost his temper at a teacher, the husband of the teacher pops him in the nose. And he says to God, yeah, thanks, God, I'm glad you heard my prayer, somewhat ironically and tragically. His faith in life, in himself, in recovery, all of this faith is shattered for him, and he is on empty. What an extraordinary condition, because we see his life and we see what he has done and he doesn't. But I'll get back to him in a moment. But first, let's look a little bit about what you thought the sermon was going to be about. And I am blending them. What is it that we fear in our society? And it's so interesting, because the things that we fear are so different from really what It's a Wonderful Life is about, which is the great existential fear of having no meaning, of being abandoned, of falling into a place of utter darkness and loneliness. It isn't a fear about death. It's a fear of dark, falling emptiness. When we look at our society, we are afraid of so much. And it isn't existential. It's situational. And an awful lot of it, while real, is also actuarially irrational. Americans are afraid of terrorism. We are scared to death of the threat of terror. It's not that terror isn't real. There is terror, but we lose 50,000 people a year in cars, 3,000 at 9/11. When we balance the realities and the fears, they don't relate. We spent 50 years in a Cold War with multiple reentry vehicle missiles with thermonuclear bombs aimed at us, moments away from extinction. And we seem to be more afraid today of terrorism. And of course, in being afraid of terrorism, we are also afraid of Muslims, Al-Qaeda, Sunni, and Iranian Shia. We are afraid of our food. The fat in it may kill us. The cows are mad. The sheep are angry. The chickens are nervous. And there is an awful lot of fish and scallops and shrimp from fetid pools in China that, if the lead doesn't get us first, is going to wipe us out. All of those are real. But these are not existential threats. We are afraid of so much. We're afraid to say anything. Kill the Empire might be misconstrued as a terrorist threat. We are afraid to touch a child out of either anger or affection. It might be misunderstood, and yet the odds are so great against something inappropriate. It's not that these fears and these challenges don't exist. It is that actuarially, we have not had a single case of mad cow death of a human being, of Jakob Creutzfeldt, that was gotten in the United States. And yet there are people who are terrified of it and have either given up meat or given up enjoying it. And they therapize all of that anxiety with drugs and cigarettes, or drink themselves into not minding that the cows are mad and the sheep are angry and the chickens are nervous and the fish are dirty. As Americans, we are afraid of losing our rights, and with some cause, and we are afraid of using our rights. I'm glad that the church in Pasadena is not getting tax exempt status yanked, but there are ministers and rabbis and imams who are afraid to say anything from a pulpit because they might lose the precious sanctity of the 501c3. This is not a chapter from the Bible, but from the tax code, which might as well be the Bible. So, as I pointed out once or twice before, when you take your deduction for your contributions to church, you are swearing that you received nothing of value. And the tax code does everything to make sure to protect your souls by making sure that you receive nothing of value. Politicians, too, are afraid to say anything that's real, that's nuanced, that's complex, because it might annoy somebody. And it might annoy somebody that has a spigot that turns on and off money. We are afraid of losing rights. We are afraid of using rights, of saying something, of complaining that may make us noticed. Or people might think that we are not patriotic or that we are neurotic. And we have to be careful. America spends a lot of time, and Americans spend a lot of time, being arrogant and cowering in fear, and there's no balance between the risks and the gains. There's no comparison between those annoying distractions that keep us frightened and the things that really eat at the heart and at the soul of human beings. I believe that most of our real fears are like George Bailey's. They aren't about things. They are, and I actually thought about whether to use this word in church, spiritual. They're spiritual concerns that aren't about things. They're about truly how we feed our souls and lead our lives and understand what is important to us. It is not that all of those things out in society aren't important to us. The food supply is something that is important. There are drug problems. Steroids are dangerous. I know this because I get steroidal psychosis when given steroids. But you know something? That's not what's killing our young people and our athletes. They are dying. They are in danger from many other things. And we are very easily distracted from the core issues of what fills us and or what leaves us feeling like George on the brink, empty. And not knowing what our life is all about. I guess people think that the movie is corny because an angel shows up, a wingless angel called Clarence, who comes to the bridge and shows him what it is that his life really was about. It's an old technique. Dickens used it. It's the other side of A Christmas Carol. Instead of a ghost showing up and giving Scrooge a tour, an angel shows up and shows George what it is that his life did. George had all of those normal Willy Loman dreams. He wanted to travel the world and be an explorer. And all he did was stay home and create a family and live a life and touch the hearts, the souls, the lives of other people. George Bailey wanted to be a great architect. He wanted to build skyscrapers a mile high. He wanted to build bridges, irony alert, 5 miles long. And he was so busy looking up at the skyscrapers he didn't build that he couldn't look down and see all of the homes he built, all of the hearths that he stoked, all of the people whose lives were touched because he had a sense, a populist sense, of social justice, that poor people deserved homes, that minorities deserved respect. And he didn't think that that counted enough. He thought that his fall from grace rendered every act of goodness, of kindness, of real values as irrelevant, and that his life was over and there was no recovery for him. But it wasn't true. What he learned was not something about fame being good or bad. What he learned is a lesson that is taught in Bible and philosophy and religion and secular psychology. It is not a question of doing great and grand things that guarantee your immortality. As Mother Teresa said, life isn't about doing great things. It's about doing small things with great love. Everyone who lives at some time, if they do any thinking at all, find themselves at some kind of emotional bridge, looking at what is reputation? What is life about? Are we failures if we don't do something great and famous? Or is success in life about people? Is the way to prevent ourselves from falling and completing a fall from grace to a bridge, to a river, to an ultimate dark, cold eternity? How do we deal with that? Not by getting other fears, not by denying other fears either, not by saying, look, I'm just not going to be afraid of anything. If you're not afraid of anything, you're not paying attention. It's a dangerous world. But be afraid in proportion to what our lives are about, to what the important things that we do are about. My uncle, Herman Wasserman, was a concert pianist and a great teacher. I say he was a great teacher not just for family legend, but he was George Gershwin's teacher and Andre Previn's teacher and Johnny Green's teacher. And our family used to think of Uncle Herman as a failure because he wasn't a famous concert pianist, which is what everybody thought he should be. And he wasn't a famous concert pianist because he had stage fright. I inherited neither his talent nor his stage fright. And I remember telling my mother when she said, oh, it's a shame about Herman. I said, what is a shame? He spent every day of his life doing something he loved that made his eyes shine. Wow. That's what success is. Having records on the chart and being famous doesn't take away death's sting, doesn't guard one from despair. The antidote to fear is not to race off at the next thing that gets our heart beating in fear. It is to try to live decent values according to our own lights. It is understanding that there are seasons, and the reason that we have these seasons in winter is an acknowledgement that life gets dark, that life takes us from time to time to a bridge, that the night looks like it will not turn into day, and the cold feels like it will never be warm again, and our spirits hover over the waters and wonder, what shall I do? Is there any coming back? What is it about? I think I'll get angry. I think I'll get frightened. I think I will exacerbate everything that makes me feel alone. The antidote to fear, some of which is normal and natural and built in, fear of falling, fear of abandonment, and George had both, having fallen from grace and having felt a sense of deep abandonment in the midst of people who love him. Understand that. This can happen to anyone in the midst of people who love us. It is to remember to look for the arms that will catch us, to look for the eyes whose light reflects and warms the light of our own lives, to do what the Unitarian poet E.E. Cummings said, to find those embers of the heart and to fan them into flames for other human beings. Because it is in loving and giving, truly, that we are loved and that we receive. We may not see it in every moment, and we should not expect to see it in every moment. But like George on the bridge, it may not be an angel that rescues us. It may not be a ghost that gives us a tour of what the world is with us or without us, but know the power that we have with each other, of how from time to time a smile, a pat, a hug, an act of encouragement plays, is picked up, is embraced, is remembered even beyond conscious memory, and then we pass it on. There are good dominoes in the world that fall in good directions when we do good things, acknowledging and welcoming and seeing and loving and celebrating and crying and holding one another. Holding one another in each other's light, as our Quaker friends say, in each other's memories, and in each other's arms. It is that that rings the bell. It is that that warms the heart. It is that that calls us back from the brink. And it is our power, often but not always, to ring that bell and touch that heart and bring others in those times when they stand at the brink back from the edge. George Bailey was not a perfect person. He had anger, he had temper, he could go off in a snit and even act almost violently. He was not a perfect man, he was simply a human being. He did not have a perfect life, achieving everything he wanted to achieve. He only had a wonderful life. And a wonderful life is one that offers us opportunities to warm, to hold, and to love. Merry Christmas.